wave superconductor, that means a superconductor where the order parameter is a spin 2 operator. And I want to discuss these systems or some related system using ADS-CFT. In order to use the ADS-CFT, I will have to introduce a charge and massive spin 2 field in the bulk. So I will present what are the problems that one encounters when trying to do this, and I will try to propose some solution to these problems. And then I will concentrate on some specific two-point functions in these field theories. And in particular, I will look at two-point function fermionic operators. I will compute retarding green function, spectral functions. And then looking and analyzing this two-point function, I will obtain some interesting features that can be compared with some with the phenomenology of some real systems. In particular, I will show some of these interesting features that come out, among which we have D-wave gap, Dirac nodes, Fermi arcs, and so on. I will explain all of these. And then I will conclude with some future directions. Okay, so just one slide on what is a real superconductor. A real superconductor essentially is a system which is characterized by a phase transition, and below this phase transition, the conductivity, the resistivity drops to zero, and here, this is the pointer. So here I'm just sketching a possible behavior of the resistivity for some conventional superconductor. So in this case, the resistivity here in this region is driven by impurities, and then at some point, resistivity drops to zero. Now, well, such a system can be described or modeled by the spontaneous breaking of a U1 symmetry. In this case, it's the U1 electromagnetic symmetry, so it's the photon. This is the usual Ginzburg-Landau theory. And actually, for most of, or for many of these systems, we have a weakly coupled description of what the physics is. And this is the famous BCS description. This is a very successful description in which, one can compute many different relations and all they work well in many systems. However, there are some other systems and for which this really coupled description doesn't work. And one example is cuprates. These are a family of high TC superconductors. So the fact that this weakly coupled description doesn't work suggests that probably one needs some different description, for instance, a strongly coupled description. Okay, and the need to find a different description was among the motivation to try to use, for instance, ADS-CFT to understand the physics of these systems. Anyway, going on, talking about real superconductors in this slide, of course, the phenomenology of a superconductor depends strongly on the nature of the order parameter that drives the breaking of the symmetry. And for instance, in the case of these cuprates, these superconductors, it turns out that the order parameter is a spin 2 order parameter. And so in this case, the nature of the order parameter gives a very interesting phenomenology that can be seen, for instance, with unresolved photoemission spectroscopy experiments and scanning and tunneling microscope experiments. And among the features that one can see, in fact, there are these features that I already mentioned, a D-wave gap, some Dirac nodes, and Fermi arcs, pseudo-gap phase, and so on. So I will describe later, I think in the next slide, some of these features. So now my motivation is the following. So I want to try to study a model which could be related to the physics behind these strongly coupled systems, well, these superconductors. And I will use ADS-CFT. However, I'm not going in any way to claim that the ADS-CFT is really a model for these systems. But rather, my motivation will be to try to study what is the physics of a strongly coupled system, and I will present an example. ADS-CFT provides an example of a strongly coupled system, and I want to see how far can we go? So I will analyze this system, and then I will compare with experiments, but I want to claim that I'm reproducing all the results. I just want to see how much of the physics depends on, say, the symmetries or just the basic features that essentially I'm putting in the slides, and I want to see how far can we go with such a description. Is there any question on this? Okay. So let me, again, give a sketch of what the physics of this system is, and we will try to see if an ADS-CFT model presents some of these features, and then I will say more in the second part of the talk. However, here there is a sketch of a typical phase diagram of one of these cuprates. So here is the doping, which is essentially the density of charge carriers. And on this line, there is temperature, and there are different phases. For instance, we have a normal phase, which is white and green here. And this normal phase, we have a Fermi surface. This can be either a Fermi liquid or a non-Fermi liquid, which has a more unusual behavior. Then there will be a superconducting phase, which is this red dome here. And in the superconducting phase, the Fermi surface is gapped. However, this is not a, say, a hard gap, or anyway, it's not a symmetric isotropic gap like in a S-wave superconductor. But rather, in this system, it is a there is a D-wave gapping, and in particular, the shape of the gap depends on an angle. So, in particular, this system has a 2+1 dimensional physics. Essentially, they are made of layers. So theta, in this case, is the angle of momentum along this plane. And so the behavior of the gap depends on the direction of the momentum in the Brillouin zone in this way. In particular, there are 4 points in the Brillouin zone along the Boulby Fermi surface where the gap goes to 0, and these are the nodes. So there are these 4 nodes. And at the nodes, there are gapless modes. So in fact, the Fermi surface is not completely gapped. And now, if you look around the nodes, there are Dirac cones. That means that the spatial relation of the particles is essentially the one of massless relativistic fermions. Of course, the speed is not the speed of light. In particular, there will be 2 different speeds, one which is parallel to the Fermi surface and one which is perpendicular to the Fermi surface. And finally, there is a very interesting phase, which is the blue phase here, which is called the pseudo-gap phase. And so in this phase, what happens is that the nodes open up into arcs. These are called Fermi arcs. And this phase is particularly interesting because from the condensed matter point of view, it has not been understood very well. There are different proposals, but there is no agreement on what the physics is. And I will say some more words.
Is that a good approximation, or that's just a function with 4 nodes?
Is it an extremely good approximation in the experiments? And I will show some plots. So in particular, looking at the experiments, and of course within the experimental sensibility, one cannot. I mean, it's hard to see some deviations, like a spin 4. Or higher spin mixing. So in fact, it is pure D-wave, a very good approximation. Of course, it depends on the systems. And let me add that this happens. So of course, okay, the model we presented is an ADS-CFT model in which, there is no Brillouin zone in the sense that there is no lattice. In the real systems, there is a Brillouin zone because there is a lattice. So in particular, the Fermi surface is not circular at all. I mean, it's a sort of rounded square. And nevertheless, this is one has this behavior, very good approximation. Okay. So on the other hand, let me just a few words say what we mean for a holographic superconductor. Well, first of all, for a holographic superfield, what is meant in the literature is essentially a field theory and typically a conformal theory, which can be studied at some temperature and some non-zero chemical potential. And this theory has a some global symmetry that typically is U1, and there is some charge of the parameter psi that can possibly break this symmetry. And on the other hand, holographic superconductor should be a system in which we weakly gauge this U1 and then becomes the photon. Now, well, strictly speaking, I will not discuss the gauging of the photon. So strictly speaking, I will talk about holographic superfluid. And, well, depending on the question, there can be a difference or essentially no difference between these two systems. In particular, for, say, homogeneous configurations, essentially there is no much difference standing with these two systems. But, for instance, if one studies vortices and so on, then there is a big difference. And, but I will not consider this, so I will study holographic superfluid.
What do you mean by weakly gauge? What does the weakly?
Well, I mean that if we want to think of the system as a, I don't know, a sort of hybrid system in which there is a strongly coupled sector which is described by gravity, and then we want to gauge this U1, of course, if U1 is strongly coupled as well.
So by weak, you mean weak small coupling terms of this opportunity?
Yes, okay. Yes. So we would like, I mean, one would like to be able to study, I don't know, perturbatively the effect of the photon. And even though I appear in the literature setups in which one can in fact just gauge the U1 within ADS-CFT, and in that case one doesn't have to worry about this problem. Okay, so we want to study the CFT as strong coupling, so natural tool is ADS-CFT. And when doing this, there are two steps. First step is to understand what is the vacuum of the theory, and this amounts to solving some classical equations in gravity, at least if the CFT is in the correct corner of parameter space. And then, after finding the vacuum, we want to analyze the properties of the vacuum, so one can look at other operators which are not directly involved in the condensation, in the breaking of the symmetry, but nevertheless, they can contain interesting information. So I will look at, in fact, fermionic operators and their two-point functions. And finally, I will adopt this bottom-up approach, in which essentially I just focus on some subset of fields. So I will not be able to specify exactly what is the theory on the boundary, but I have in mind that it will be some large N field theory. And having in mind at some point, one could try to embed this in an honest string theory embedding, in which essentially these fields or not many more fields appear, you know, in a consistent reduction, and in which the Lagrangian will be similar to the one I will consider. Okay, and so I will also say something about how much general is the Lagrangian I will consider, and so on. Okay, this slide is probably useless for this audience, but I wanted in one slide to summarize the rules of ADS-CFT. I'm not going to go into the details of this in the following. I will consider some CFT in D dimension with some stress energy tensor. So this corresponds to consider some gravity theory, and I will consider Einstein-Hilbert gravity in an asymptotic ADS-D+1 theory. Then I want to consider a U1 global symmetry with some current operator, so it will correspond to some UA, having some U1 gauge symmetry in the bulk. And I want to have a charge order parameter that can possibly break the symmetry, so some operator of dimension delta. This corresponds to having a charge and possibly massive field in the bulk. I will put my CFT at some non-zero temperature, so this corresponds to considering a black hole in ADS, which asymptotically we have. ADS metric, and I want to turn on a chemical potential, I mean a source for the zero component of the current operator, so this will correspond to specifying some boundary condition for the gauge field, and I have two integration constants, one is the source, one is the VEV, so I will specify the source and can read off what is the VEV, which is the charge density. Same story for my order parameter. There will be two integration constants. I indicate I will impose that there is no source for the order parameter, and I will read off what the bev is, which is the condensate. And finally, I want to study a Gaussian and Lorentzian CFT, so I will have Lorentzian signature and want to consider regular and fully boundary conditions at the horizon. So these are rules of the game. Okay. So, well, the case I'm interested in is a D-wave superconductor, so I want to introduce an order parameter to use D-wave, a spin-to-order parameter. And, well, we know of a field in gravity which has spin 2. This is the graviton. However, the graviton is neutral. I want to consider a charge spin 2 operator. So this cannot be the graviton. In particular, it cannot be massless, so it must be massive. And so I have to introduce a new massive charge spin 2 field in the bulk. Now, there are many problems that could arise when one tries to do this. And, okay, some of these problems. And the following, one can have the wrong number of degrees of freedom. One can have ghosts. This is, of course, a very serious problem. And one can have some faster-than-light signals when on a non-trivial background. This is also an unwanted feature. So the basic question is, what is the action we should consider for this charge massive spin-2 field? Okay, just to give you a feeling of what the problems are, so suppose I consider a very simple situation, a flat space-time and a neutral spin-2 field. I can think of describing it with a symmetric rank 2 tensor. If I'm new, I can try to write down this very simple action. We have a kinetic term and a mass term. So, of course, this is not good. Because, well, first of all, the number of degrees of freedom is wrong because you count the number of components in a symmetric tensor. It turns out to be this number, depending on the dimension of the boundary theory. But a massive spin 2 particle has a smaller number of components. In particular, there are d+2 components more. Now, one could say, OK, I don't care. Maybe I'm not just describing a spin 2 particle. I'm describing something more. But the point is that there are ghosts. And this just comes from looking at this kinetic term. There are components with the wrong sign. So, of course, we don't want the ghosts. We want to get rid of them. And a solution was found quite long ago by Fritz and Pauli, who wanted to consider a quadratic action in spin 2 fields, so a linearized action, and with terms up to two derivatives. And essentially, this is the action they found. So the first four terms are the kinetic term, and this term is the mass term, which also has a peculiar form. And here I'm using a notation in which phi with a single index is a divergence, and the phi without indices is the trace. Okay, so why this action is good and solve the problems? Well, very easily, because one works out the equation of motion, and playing with them, they can be rearranged in this way. So the first one is just the Klein-Gordon equation for the components. That means they have causal propagation. However, there are d+2 other equations in which there are no second derivatives. So these, rather being a dynamical equation, there are constraint equations that precisely fix d+2 components. So I have the correct number of degrees of freedom. And then one can check that one can compute the propagator for the remaining components, and one can check that there are no ghosts. So this is a good action that solves all the problems. Okay. Now, as I wrote in the previous slide, these under some conditions, this action is actually unique. And in particular, if one looks for an action which is quadratic in the spin-2 field and up to two derivatives, then this is unique in the following sense. One can try to write down all possible terms, and all the coefficients are fixed by either of these methods. For instance, one can just require that there are d+2 constrained equations, that means equations in which there are no second derivatives. This fixes all the coefficients. Or equivalently, one can use the Stueckelberg formalism. So essentially, one introduces more degrees of freedom, but also some gauge invariance. And in this case, the new degrees of freedom are a vector and a scalar. When you do that, you get some new gauge invariance, which essentially corresponds to what would be diffeomorphisms and gauge transformations. And actually, when you do that, what you see that here there are two derivatives, here you get one more. So in total, there are terms with six derivatives. So you can ask that all the terms with more than two derivatives cancel out. And again, this fixes all the coefficients. Or you can just compute the propagator and require that there are no ghosts nor tachyons. And again, this fixes all the coefficients in the same way. OK. So flat space, time, and neutral field, problem solved a long time ago. However, we want to consider, first of all, a charge spin to field, and we want to put it on a non-trivial background because there will be, well, the gravitational background will be some asymptotic ADS, possibly some black hole, and there will be some non-trivial gauge field and so on. So okay, the natural thing to do is just to substitute the normal derivative with the covariant derivative. Okay, so we do that. However, when we do that, we get all the problems back, and in particular, we have the ghosts. Why is that? Well, simply because the covariant derivatives are not commuting, and so in particular, this delicate cancellation that was in the constraint equation is no longer there. You get all the second derivative terms, so all the equations are dynamical, and in particular, there are also the ghosts. So one has to do something with that. And it turns out that this problem can be solved by solving, can be solved by coupling our spin to field with the curvature. So introducing extra coupling with the curvature, in particular the gravitational curvature and the gauge curvature. So the strategy that one can try to adopt is just write down the most general action, which is quadratic in the spin to fields, and with terms up to two derivatives, and without irrelevant operators, so up to dimension d plus 1 operators, and require then in d plus 2 equations all terms with two derivatives cancel out, so require that one gets the constraint equations. So can we actually do that? So let's look separately at the metric and the gauge field. So first of all, looking at the metric, it turns out that for on a generic background, this problem cannot be solved. So there is no choice of the coefficients such that you get constraint equations. However, if the background is Einstein, that means it solves the vacuum equation, possibly with a cosmological constant, then the problem can be solved. So there is a choice of the coupling such that you get the constraint equations. Now, this condition that the background is Einstein means that somehow one has to work in a probe limit in which the spin-to-field is not backreacting on the metric, because, of course, if one introduces the stress tensor of the spin-to-field, then this will make the background no longer Einstein. So, okay, then what happens when one looks at the gauge field? Well, it turns out that actually there are no constraints on the gauge field, and so the background can be generic, and then one finds coupling that exactly gives the d plus 2 constraints and get rid of the ghosts.
What's the meaning of this result, the fact that you cannot couple to a general background
metric? Well, it probably means, even though it's not been proven, that if you want a theory which is fully dynamical, so in which all the fields are dynamical and in particular the spin to field is coupled to the metric, you probably need an infinite tower of modes. This doesn't necessarily mean that all these modes are higher spin modes. They could just be spin 2 modes. And for this one example is that you can take gravity in one dimension more, you could have some KK reduction, and then when you go down, you find a tower of massive spin to fields, which are also charged. So exactly what you're looking at. And you know that if you keep the whole tower, it's fine, because it's just gravity in one dimension more. But if you only keep the first mode, you have a similar problem that you cannot make all of them dynamical in a consistent way.
Is that how these folks approach the problem, by starting by the Kluge-Klein theory, or
No. What they did was, in fact, looking essentially multi-general quadratic action and try to see if there is a way of fixing the coefficients in such a way that.
If you start with the Kluge-Klein, then do you know?
No, they don't.
But if I did start with Kluge-Klein and say that's a theory with massive charge in two fields, would I have ended up at the same points? You know.
So this was considered by Naffi and Witten, and they just considered compactification on a circle. And so they performed this Kaluza-Klein reduction, and what they so if you do this Kaluza-Klein reduction on the circle, you of course get at the say massless level, you get the graviton and the gauge field, and then you have this tower of modes which are charged and massive. And so what they found is that in their case, instead of being forced to be on Einstein, essentially you have to solve for the massless sector, so essentially you have to solve the equation for gravity in the gauge field alone, and then on this background, you can put a probe as a probe the massive spin 2 field. So essentially what happens in this case is that there is some, say, massless sector, you have to solve separately for the massless sector, and then on this you can put as a probe your first element. Well, it doesn't have to be the first, your single spin 2 field. And then it must be a probe. So if it is a probe, you solve all the problems. If you try to backreact it, you can get different problems like ghosts or faster than light signals and so on. So in that approach, again, the difference is that, so here, if I try to use this action that I will write in the next slide, I have to consider the gravity as the coupled, while the gauge field can be coupled to the spin 2 field. In their approach, you have gravity and gauge field which are coupled together, and you solve for them, and then you put the spin 2 field.
Sometimes, aren't you making, or whatever, in this approach, aren't you making the gauge field another probe, and that it can't back react on the.
It can back react on the metric. So I have to be. It cannot.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So I have to see if there is a limit. Because I want to do a DSFT at the end, if there is a limit in which this situation is realized, in which, again, spin 2 field and gauge fields are coupled together, but they do not backreact on the metric. And, and in fact, you can realize both limits in a DSFT, both the one in which you have gravity on one side and gauge field and spin 2 on one side, or gravity and gauge field on one side and spin 2 on the other side. But the latter is not good for doing this, because if the spin 2 is not backreacting on the gauge field and metric, then essentially, okay, you cannot compute anything. Even the conductivity would be insensible to this, so it's probably not a regime that. Essentially, would be a regime in which, okay, maybe you condense, you break the symmetry, but the theory is not really. I mean, you're breaking in a very small way, and so the theory doesn't realize it.
Signature in deep, all these are in deep plus one dimensions, right?
Yeah.
What is the signature in deep plus one dimensions?
Oh, it's the usual Lorentzian signature, one
so comma
d.
It's not a ds.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's the usual. Okay, here I'm very generic, so I'm not specifying a background, but the signature is the usual, one comma
so
d.
So it's the usual.
Yeah.
So it's this space plus one.
Yes.
So the because say effective action, then you truncate to a single field, right? So at least we don't know how to consistently write it down. But one possibility, as you said, of thinking in terms of goes a client truncation.
Yes.
In which the charge occurs just sort of momentum of the circuit.
Yes.
Is there a way in which, you know, all this spin 2 superconductivity, you can try to uplift it back into normal gravity where, you know?
Well, I didn't try. And essentially, I think the reason is that so if you do this Kaluza-Klein reduction, you get that okay, the mass and the charge they are related, something like the mass squared is proportional to the charge, and then you look at the critical temperature, and you see that essentially the critical temperature depends on this ratio. So what happens is that you, of course, you should work out the details, but you expect that all these modes at some point condense all together, probably with an amplitude that goes to zero in such a way that it's integrable, it's summable, but they probably condense all together. So I don't expect that you can something like, okay, there is a single mode which is condensing, I uplift, and I find easily a solution. I will probably have to just solve the equation in one dimension more with total, I mean, losing totally the symmetry on the circle. And so that is something that in principle one can just do. Just the point is that is well, more difficult and actually I think is technically a little bit challenging from the numerical point of view. Yeah.
Probably we'll get similar relations in this case as well. So in other words, is it even possible for the Kaluza-Klein modes to condense?
Yeah. So as I will show in the next slide, so in order to realize this limit in which I can use my action in a reliable way, I have to take a large charge limit. And so, essentially, I don't see a ratio a bound on the ratio in the sense of the ratio is just inside the bound.
So that would be an indication that in the new Kaluza-Klein,
well, if you do the Kaluza-Klein reduction, you keep all the modes, then you are no longer in this. You are not forced to be in this limit. So, yes. Okay. Here's the action one can get. So first line is just the Fields-Pauli action with covariant derivative. And here there are these extra coupling that one has to introduce. They are very simple. So first of all, they are still quadratic in spin to field. They are linear in the curvatures, Riemann and scalar curvature. And here there is a dipole term to the coupling to the gauge field. Okay, so... as I said, in order to reliably use this action, one has to be in a probe limit. So the question is there a limit in ADS-CFT? I want to do ADS-CFT in which this limit is realized. And the answer is yes. So one has to take a very large charge and very small chemical potential, but keeping the product fixed. So this is the chemical potential per unit particle. And so one can simply see that if you take this Lagrangian and you take this limit, essentially all this piece, this matter action is divided by Q, so in the large Q limit, this goes to zero and the stress tensor doesn't back react on the metric. So in order to use this action, I will be forced to work in this probe limit. Okay. As I said, there are no constraints on the gauge field. If I require, there are the constraints equation, and there are no ghosts. However, there is another problem, which is the problem that as soon as I switch on gauge, a non-trivial gauge background, I can get faster than light signals. And in particular, this is the maximal speed of signals. Well, one is the speed of light. So this violation of the bound is controlled by this parameter QF over M squared. And well, actually, there are two things that one should check. So first of all, one wants to know if there is a well-posed Cauchy problem, so that one can specify initial conditions and then the equation just propagate the signals with a finite cone. And so this means, in other words, the question whether the equations are hyperbolic. And in fact, if this parameter is small enough, there is a bound, but this bound is a finite number. So if this this quantity here doesn't violate this order one number, then in fact the equations are hyperbolic. So there are signals propagating inside a cone, but then one can compute how large is this cone, and one sees that this cone is large in the cone of light by this amount.
What is that absolute value? What does that really mean?
So essentially, you have to look for f, let's say, upper index, lower index, in field binary coordinates. Yeah, so...
is it a particular component? I don't know,
PR? Oh, no, so this is, different components contribute in a different way, so you have to look at the different components, and I didn't want to write down the whole formula. So essentially what you have to do is, to look which components creates the strongest violation. But the point is that as soon as you turn on any possible component in an electric field or magnetic field, both components contribute to this violation. And, so this is, of course, an unwanted feature because, if I have sort of violation of causality in the bulk, of course, this can propagate violation of causality in the boundary. So this is a feature we don't want. But actually, this is a very hard problem to solve, at least with a finite number of fields. So let me tell you what people tried in the literature to solve this problem. And one approach to the problem was given by Argyris and Nappi. And so they wanted to see if it is possible to write down an action which is still quadratic in the spin-2 field with up to two derivatives, but in which there is causal propagation, so there is no this violation. And the strategy was to look at the bosonic open string. And so in the bosonic open string, at the massless level, you have gravity in the gauge field. If you look at the first massive level, in fact, you have a charge and massive spin-2 field. So they wrote down the effective action for this single mode, the linearized action for this mode. And so what they got is, in fact, an action. So this action lives in 26 dimensions. This is because they use bosonic string theory. And it works in flat space-time and the constant magnetic field, because otherwise they are not able to solve for the sigma model. But what they found is, in fact, a causal action for this spin-2 field. Now, what is the form of this action? I'm going to show it in a second. It's a kind of very complicated action. But essentially, this action has the same form of this action here. Of course, there is no coupling to the metric because they are in flat space-time, but in which each term of this action, they are some nonlinear function of the gauge field. So here is the action, and I'm not going to go into the details, just let me say a few things. So the small h is the spin-2 field, and you can see that this is quadratic in the spin-2 field. Then this calligraphic p is essentially a derivative. And you can check that there are up to two derivatives. However, it's not just the usual derivative, but rather it is essentially a twisting of the derivative by the gauge field. So it's some nonlinear, complicated function of the gauge field that contains a single derivative. And finally, there is this big H and this epsilon, and these, again, are some functions of the gauge field. So what you can do is the following. You take this action, which, first of all, you can check that propagation is causal. You have Klein-Gordon equation. Everything was fine. So you take this action, and you take this function of the gauge field. You Taylor expand them, and you only keep the terms, which are, so you throw away an irrelevant operator. Essentially, you just keep the linear couplings to the gauge field, and what you are left with is precisely the action that I wrote down before. So essentially, what happens in this action is that this action solves the problem by including higher dimensional operators, which are higher order couplings to the gauge field. And each time you include a new coupling, essentially you push the violation of causality to second order in F. Then you have more terms, you push it to third order in F. And only once you have added all the possible terms, then you have causal propagation. Okay, so the way in which I want to think, I'm not going to use this action, also because this action was in 26 dimensions, and not in 4, even though there is some work going on in trying to generalize this to generic dimension.
In less than 26 dimensions. It's a field theory, after all.
It's it's a field theory. Yeah. So, okay, from the field theory point of view, you just take this action, you work out the equations of motion, you play the usual games, and you see that 26 comes out. And in particular, there is, so you get the constraint equation.
You can fix the coefficients. So it works in other dimensions.
So,
probably, you know, the coefficients.
So if you just take this, you see that there is a 26 minus d, and so, okay.
It's fixed in 26, but can you not play with the coefficients?
Well, this is what people is trying to do, but you see, well, here there are many terms, and it's not that this term is kind of irreducible. So probably if you try to write down everything you can write down, I don't even know if this is a finite number of terms. So. Without some guiding principle is, I think, very hard. And, for instance, this is for spin 2. If you look at spin 3 halves, an action with the similar properties has been, so the problem has been solved in generic dimensions. In fact, it's been solved last year by Porati and Raman. And in that case, their action worked in any dimension. Of course, they had some way of writing down an educated guess. But, you know, the higher you go with the spin, it can be the more problems you get. So it's not obvious that this will work. And then, from the string theory point of view, you know that how the 26 comes out, just casting the anomalies. So it's not obvious whether one can generalize it, generic dimension or not.
So this clone exists also in flat space, is that right? This, like, you have a gauge field, but a trivial metric background?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah, the gravitational background, if you are in the probe limit, is not going to give you such a problem. It's not a violation of causality. And, Okay. So the way in which I will think about my action is that I will take this parameter very small, and I will have in mind that every quantity I compute essentially is first order in these parameters, and I will have in mind that probably maybe problems can be solved by adding higher dimensional operators, and if this parameter is small, they will correct in a very small way, all observables I will compute. And having this parameter small corresponds to having a large dimension for spin to field, for the dual operator. Okay. And then, I'm just mentioning this other possible solution to the problem, which is doing a Kaluza-Kamen reduction. As I said, there is a sort of massless sector of fields that can must be put on shell by itself, and then on this sector of fields, one can have possibly a sector of KK fields, and one can use them in a linearized approximation without making them back react on the massless sector. Okay. Is there any other question on this? Okay, so that is the action I want to use. So then I want to do some ADA CFT with this action. So now there are the usual rules. There is a correspondence between field and boundary operators. I have second-order boundary equation, second-order asymptotic, second-order differential equation. So I solve them asymptotically. I found two integration constants, and one is the source, one is the VEV. There will be a relation between the mass of the field and the dimension of the operator. Now, there is a bound, a lower bound, on the dimension of the operator, which is a sort of equivalent of the BF bound. And in the field theory, this comes just from this unitarity bound, comes from the conformal algebra. And in gravity, one can repeat the BF computation and see that when the dimension is D, which is the dimension of the stress tensor, if you plug it here, you find that the mass is zero, which is the mass of the graviton. And in the gravity, you can see that if you try to make the mass smaller than zero, then the energy is not bounded below, and so the system is unstable. Okay. So, okay, this is the answer that we consider. So the metric must be Einstein. So essentially, it's the ADS black hole. And here I'm turning on this component of gauge field that corresponds to having some chemical potential. And then I will look for an answer for the spin 2 field in which I just turn on some boundary, some components, not a long time, a long space, and in particular along just a plane in the space. And then later, so this is general n dimensional, but later I will just consider 2 plus 1 dimensional system. So these are the only space components. And, okay, I worked out the equations of motion. I find that the equations are the same as in the S-wave case, so I already know what is going to happen. That means that I turn on a chemical potential, it creates a critical temperature, and above the critical temperature, I am the normal state in which there is no condensate, and below the critical temperature, the favored phase is the one in which there is a condensate. And here, for instance, I'm taking the dimension 2 plus 1, and I'm plotting the behavior of the condensate. But this is the same as the S-wave case. I can also compute the conductivity, and I can see that, so in this case, the conductivity is not the same in the S-wave case, because I'm putting oscillations on the background, but I can see that there is a superconducting peak at zero frequency, so this is in fact a superconducting phase. However, I would like to, so far it's not extremely exciting because it's the same as the scalar case. I would like to see some anisotropy, so one could think of just looking at the conductivity as a matrix, and however, it turns out that if I am in 2 plus 1 dimension, this conductivity is isotropic. And this isotropy is not due to ADS-CFT or large N or anything. It's just that, also in a real system, the linear response due to the D-wave symmetry is just a matrix which is proportional to the identity. So it's not like in the P-wave case. So essentially, there is no anisotropy in the plane.
Just to understand what you did. You started from the D plus 1, the 4 plus 1. I mean.
Well, so far D is generic, so.
Okay, D plus 1 dimensional action. You took a particular ansatz.
Yeah.
You plugged it in.
Yeah.
And what you find is, like, is ordinary.
Yeah, so essentially I find that, above the critical temperature I just have this solution, which is written here, and below the critical temperature I have 2 solutions. I've not written them down, but. Essentially, this field is different from zero, A is something else, and then you compute the free energy, and you see that below the critical temperature, this is favored. So, this is the same as it was already done in the S-wave case. So from this point of view, there are no big surprises. And so far, nothing exciting. So in order to see something more interesting, I'll have to look to fermions, to fermionic spectral function. So I'm going to move there if there are no other questions on the first part. I'm going to try to be fast. Okay, so we want to look at fermions. Of course, in ADS-CFT, we can just look at gauge invariant operators. So I will study fermionic operators. So spin or in the bulk corresponds to some composite fermionic operator in the boundary. And now from the point of view of, say, weakly gauging the U1, this is a sort of composite electron, so it's not that bad. And what I want to do is to compute a retarded Green function, which is a two-point function in this fermionic operator, and then taking this imaginary part, which with some abuse of terminology I can call the spectral function. And this spectral function computes density of states. And this is particularly interesting because one can directly connect this computation with experiments. In particular, there are these Angle-Soff automation spectroscopy experiments in which people sense photons on the sensor. So they have this sample of the superconductor. They send a photon, this kick out an electron, and they measure it. And measuring the momentum and energy of the electron, they can reconstruct what is the density of states in the superconductor, because, of course, you get an electron if there was a state for it. Okay. And so you, so from these experiments, they get density of states, and you can directly compare with what you compute in the system. Now, of course, the question is, what action do you take for these fermions? And in this case, I want to be very generic. So now my bulk theory is in four dimensions. I want to consider all possible terms up to dimension five, so already including some irrelevant operators. And essentially, it turns out that these are all the terms you can write down. So this is just the usual Dirac term. Here there is a sort of effective mass for the fermion, and so this probably would represent a sort of renormalization of the mass of the fermionic operator in the presence of a condensate. However, this is not going to give me some anisotropy, so I will not consider this term here, even though it could be interesting. And I will focus on these two terms. However, these are sort of Majorana-like terms in the sense that here I have the conjugate of the fermion. And these terms can be, they are not mutually compatible. I can write down either one, the other, or none of them, depending on the charges of the fields. Because if I give some charge here, I have the same charge, and then the charge must cancel with the charge of this. So now the situation I have in mind is the following for my boundary theory, that there will be some microscopic fermions, and I want this pin 2 field to represent a sort of Cooper pair, so it will be a bilinear in the microscopic fermion. So essentially, I want this to have twice the charge than the microscopic fermion. On the other hand, this fermionic operator will be a gauge invariant of the matrix of a fermion and another microscopic boson, so it will have the same charge as the microscopic fermion. So the situation I have in mind is the one in which the charge of this guy is twice than the charge of this guy. And with this assignment, I can write down the first term, and I cannot write down the second term. So this is essentially the only thing I can write down. And notice that, in fact, this term makes use of the spin to structure, because here the two indices which are constructed in some tensor way, while, for instance, in this term, there is no anisotropy because I just get a scalar from this, and then the fermions do not see the D-wave nature of the order parameter. So essentially, the only term I can write down with the charges that reproduce the situation I have in mind have some hope of giving the anisotropy I'm looking for. So depending on the charges, this one or this one are allowed, and I will choose the spin to have twice the charges as this one, and then this one is allowed, and this one is not allowed, because this is allowed if the charge of phi is the same as the charge of psi. Okay.
Instead of psi, in the second term, instead of psi c bar,
yeah,
you could put psi bar.
Yeah, so you get something like this term.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
and but again, here I get a scalar. This is interesting, but this is, yeah. In particular, this term is going to give a gapping on the Fermi surface. This term is not going to be there. Okay. So, I want to compute the two-point function, and I'm not going to the details of this computation, this standard computation in ADS-CFT. Let me just say that, okay, you take these equations of motion, and you compute the solutions, and asymptotically you have two integration constants. One is the source, and the other one is the response. And now the retarded Green function is a response function, so essentially it's the ratio between the response and the source. And so essentially, okay, you write down the response as a function of the source, and you read off this matrix, and this is the retarded Green function. But this is a standard computation. Compute this Green function, and then you take the imaginary part. This is the spectral function, so this counts density of states, and this is a function of frequency and momentum. Momentum is in the plane, and then there is frequency. So what happens is that if this function is order one, you just have a continuum of states, but if this function has a peak, or even better, a delta function, then this means that you have some quasi-normal modes, and you can write down a dispersion relation for the quasi-normal modes. So this is what I'm going to do. And so let me sketch how this Majorana-like coupling produces a gapping of the Fermi surface. Let me consider what happens in the S-wave case, and let me turn off the Majorana-like coupling, and let's see what happens. So I solve the Dirac equation for the fermion, and I read off this spectral function, and the spectral function is kind of represented here. Here is momentum, here is frequency, and I'm plotting here where the location of the peaks of the spectral function, and essentially then I can obtain a dispersion relation. The dispersion relation is this kind of form, this cup, and then if I consider the dispersion relation at zero frequency, so I cut it here, I get my Fermi surface. And now, if I turn on this Majorana-like coupling, this psi bar C psi coupling with the condensate, this is introducing this term in the Dirac equation. But this term mixes psi with psi conjugate. So here is the special relation of psi. Here is the special relation for psi conjugate. And this equation, which, since it is conjugated, it has opposite momentum and opposite frequency. And now you couple them together with this equation. And so what happens is that along this surface, there is a degeneracy of states because there are two states with the same momentum. And then when you couple them together, you have eigenvalue repulsion. And so you create a gap. So this is what you get. So this Majorana-like coupling, what it does is precisely to producing a gap in the Fermi surface. Any question on this mechanism? Okay. So to conclude, so let me now look at what happens in our D-wave case in which the coupling, the Majorana-like coupling, is this one. And in order to analyze what the behavior is, I will proceed in a way which is similar to what experimentalists do. So essentially what they do is that they fix some angle in momentum space, this theta, in the Brownian zone, and they plot the spectral function as a function of momentum in this line and frequency. So here is momentum, and here is zero. Here is frequency, here is zero. So this is the chemical potential, the Fermi energy. And then they look at the peaks. This is a density plot, so these white lines are the peaks of the spectral function. And for instance, here, at a generic angle, you see that there is a gapping of the would-be Fermi surface, because here you create a gap. So you repeat this procedure for all the possible angles, and you write down, so first of all, you identify the would-be Fermi momentum, which is the momentum at which this gap is minimal, and then you plot the spectral function along this line, which is called energy distribution curve. And this is plotted here. So this is an experimental result. I will show our numerics. But so what they do is that they plot the spectral function for each of these corresponds to a different angle. They are just superposed to make it clear. And then you see at some angle there is a single peak. That means that there is no gapping. At some other angle there are two peaks with a drop here. That means that there is a gapping of the Fermi surface. So let's see what happens. Okay, here is my numeric results for different values of temperature, and here is the same thing in some experimental sample. This is one of the cuprates. And here is small temperature, and then in the interior is higher temperature. So if you see at small temperature, like here, you see there is a gap for any value of the angle, but at some specific angle, the same is here. So what happens is that the Fermi surface is gapped everywhere, but at these four nodes. And I was plotting the angle just in essentially in this range because the rest is obtained by D-wave symmetry. And you can also plot the gap as a function of the angle. So look at this blue curve, which is called low temperature, and here is a similar experimental result. So look at these red dots, and so again you see that this gap everything but the node, and you can see that the behavior is very well fitted by this function, and this also happens here in this experimental setup within the approximation sensibility. Okay. Then, you can look at what is the behavior of the nodes. So here I'm plotting the dispersion relation. Here is the node. Again, this is displaying its momentum, and here I have frequency, and you see that they have a sort of Dirac cone. However, with two different velocities, one velocity is perpendicular to the Fermi surface, and one velocity is parallel to the Fermi surface. And for instance, you can arrange the Majorana-like coupling easily in order to obtain a range of values which are within the experimental observations. Okay, and okay, finally I want to go to higher temperature. So for instance here or here, so when you increase the temperature, after some point you see that there are some angles with a gap and some other angles without a gap. So essentially what happens is that this node opens up into an arc. And you can see it also here. If you look at these white and yellow dots or red dots, you see that there is some temperature where, there is some angle where the gap drops down, and the same is here. So essentially, the nodes open up into arcs. And so here is some numeric results in which so this plane is momentum, essentially it's the Brillouin zone if you want, and I'm plotting a density plot of the gap. So you see here, so this line corresponds to the node open up into an arc, and here you see that the arc essentially reconstruct the full Fermi surface, and here is some similar experimental result. And finally, this is the last slide. We can try to see how much we can push the system. So we can look at what is the dependence of the length of the arc as an angle with temperature. So here is some experimental result. And you see that the length of the arc is with very good approximation, is essentially linear in the temperature. And however, here is our numeric results, and in this case, you see the dependence is not linear at all. So here, this similarity with the experimental setup breaks down. However, one interesting point is that these arcs in a true system, they appear in this pseudo-gap phase, which is this mysterious phase, which has not been understood very well, in which somehow superconductivity is destroyed even though there is a gapping of the Fermi surface. And so far we don't have, we have not found this pseudo-gap phase in this holographic setup. So before looking at very precise details of the behavior of the system, probably one should try to understand if a pseudo-gap phase is present in these holographic setups. And again, this pseudo-gap phase is extremely interesting because essentially there are different proposals for it in the condensed matter literature, and there is a debate. In particular, it's not clear whether there is a competition of order parameters or rather there is a single order parameters, but quantum fluctuations destroy superconductivity still having a pairing of electrons into Cooper pairs. And so probably if there is a competition of other parameters, there is some hope that the ADS-CFT can describe it. If, however, it is due to large quantum fluctuation, it's not very clear, because usually in the large end limit you suppress these very large quantum fluctuations. So it's not obvious that ADS-CFT, even being strongly coupled, can reproduce such a behavior. Okay, so we'll conclude with some future directions. And one thing one can try to do is to improve the action, maybe along the lines of Argyris-Napi, generalizing to other dimensions. However, probably the best thing to do would be to consider a fully consistent model in which one does a KK decomposition, but not a reduction, so keeping all the tower of modes, essentially studying gravity in one dimension more. This will give a model in which one can also back react and so on. And this is numerically challenging, but from the conceptual point of view, it's not difficult. it will be very interesting to see if a pseudo gap phase can be arranged within this framework. There are other things that one can try to see. For instance, well, in true systems, it is believed that there is a quantum critical point, but this quantum critical point doesn't have to be relativistic. Well, the theory they describe was relativistic, so one can try to study non-relativistic scaling, or one can try to introduce inhomogeneities, because, of course, in a real system, there is a lattice, and it's likely that inhomogeneities can play a big role. For instance, it has been shown that they also can give rise to Fermi arcs. And finally, I consider a real ansatz for my spin 2 field. However, one can consider a more general complex ansatz. This would be a sort of a chiral D plus ID superconductivity. It would be a vacuum with some Hall conductivity and boundary currents and so on. So this could be something interesting to study. Thank you.
Microscopic description that goes on for the Fermi arcs. Is there?
In condensed matter?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of models in condensed matter. Some of them are more phenomenological, some of them less. The problem is that, so there are really tons of models. The problem is that usually these models can reproduce some aspects, but they cannot reproduce all the physics. So there is still a lot of debate. So I think most of these models, either they introduce by hand some band structure, and then they try to compute what is the behavior of the system, so the spectral function from this band structure. I don't think there is a fully microscopic derivation. Otherwise, I mean, people know what the answer is. But the main problem is that really there are these two kind of orthogonal directions, one with competing order and one with destruction of superconductivity. They are really two different mechanisms, the problematic thing is that some experiments seem to point in some direction, some other experiments point in the other direction. So even in the experimental literature, there's a lot of debate, so it's not easy to understand what is going on.
But using this formulate, may you write also some kind of volume of the GM equation for
this?
Something similar, because,
yeah. When there is this Majorana-like coupling, yeah, it's very similar. In fact, it's, well...
Yeah, but just explicitly.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you can write down these Eigen vectors, which are mixing of psi and psi conjugate, which is essentially the same thing as that transformation.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, in what temperature range do you find the Fermi arcs in your model? Just above TC? Or
no, that's the problem, that it is below TC.
Below TC, okay.
So there is some critical temperature. There is some temperature where the nodes start opening up into an arc, and then this goes up to, well, some other temperature where essentially you reconcile the full Fermi surface, and this is all below TC.
Okay.
So it is in the superconducting phase, not in the pseudogap phase.
Right. Is there really a node at some, does it become a node for some range of temperatures, and then at some
well, I mean, of course, at finite temperature, there is some, you don't have exactly normal modes, you have quasi-normal modes because there is some broadening,
right.
But yeah, it is a node. And if you would be at if you were at zero temperature, there would be nodes.
Then there'd be a sharp temperature, which
yes.
There'd be TC1, and then the node would become an arc, and then TC2
yes.
Would vanish.
Yes. I mean, sharp temperature. I mean, there is no an order parameter. So in this sense, it's not a phase transition. So it's sharp as long as you are defining temperature. So of course. If you don't have another parameter to start getting a VEV, it cannot be completely sharp. But.
Okay, so if there are any further questions, just before we thank Francesco again, let me advertise that there's another string seminar, yet another string seminar tomorrow in here at the same time, 11, by Matthew. for now, let's thank Francesco for asking.